thank you so much. Thanks for the invite. Very happy to be here. It's a pretty horrific start to a presentation to show the recorded migrant deaths by region, but something that we can't avoid. It's very in our face, isn't it, in Europe. This is the IOM Missing Migrants breakdown of border deaths by region. You can see the massive three quarters of these are in the Mediterranean. And the other region which I'll be looking at, US-Mexico, less deaths recorded, but still a significant issue. We can see this is a global issue, isn't it? As I'm sure everyone's aware. So I'm going to present today a paper that I've just recently had accepted for publication in European Journal of International Relations. And I'm just going to run through that paper, basically. So I hope you haven't read it, but this is a nice summary. Now, the broad concerns, questions that I put forward in this paper are twofold. Firstly, how to make sense of the emergence of death as a routine or normalised dimension of contemporary bordering practices between more or less stable and privileged regions. Okay, so... Of course, European Mediterranean context, if we take that context, there's been deaths for, you know, several decades now. We've seen a massive increase over recent past few years. US, similarly, there's a longer history from the mid-1990s, as we'll see, of deaths in this region. So this is not, although, you know, the crisis discourse we've seen in Europe over the past few years presents it as this brand new thing, you know, of course it's got this longer history. These border deaths have a longer history. So how has this become a normal part of our world today? And the second question that I pose is, what possibilities exist for transformation of this troubling situation where death is a norm through which migration is governed? So those are my broad questions. And I focus, as Julian introduced, on a comparative analysis between US-Mexico border and the southern European, northern Africa border, the Mediterranean Sea. So looking at the desert as a site in the US-Mexico context and the sea in the European. So what I'm interested in here is looking at the convergences and contextualised mutations of bordering practices and mechanisms of dealing with border deaths in each case. But just to say, this is not a sort of traditional comparative analysis of two cases, full-scale comprehensive empirical analysis of those two distinct case studies, but rather I'm looking at contextualised differences and affinities in these practices of governing migration through death, but in terms of problematises distinction between these two sites. So I wouldn't go so far as to say this is a global kind of process of governing migration through death. It's not global in a universal sense, but neither is it, you know, specific just to one or two places. But it's a broader phenomenon. Okay, so that's just to introduce the focus. In terms of the research that I'm drawing on for this article, I did. Some of you might be familiar with this book I wrote in 2015, which is what I drew on my fieldwork on the US-Mexico border, which I carried out 2011-2012. And so this was a sort of ethnographic, interview-based approach, looking at humanitarian activism in this context. And my current project, I'm looking at migrant deaths, border deaths in the Mediterranean. This is a Leverhulme Research Fellowship, which I'm 1 year into, not 1 year out of 2 years into. I'm a little bit behind, so I wouldn't want to say I'm 50% through, but you know, this is the project I'm working on currently. Okay, so In terms of governing migration through death, what I draw on particularly for my work in the US-Mexico context is a term I use, which I call biophysical violence. So biophysical violence, how I define that, is when people are abandoned to physical forces which directly operate on bodily functions with often devastating consequences. So I'm interested in here in, you know, the rising numbers of border deaths that happen in contexts of extreme environmental exposure. Deserts and seas mobilise as part of the, you know, the operation of a border regime, if you like. So here, biophysical violence, what I'm pointing to here is how natural physical elements become enrolled in operations of power. And I talk in the paper about this blurring of the distinction between killing and letting die. And that connects to the concepts, the theoretical resources I draw on in terms of understanding this phenomenon of governing migration through death. So in the paper I draw on other scholarship, of course lots of scholars have done excellent work in this area, drawing on Foucault's biopolitics, Agamben's ideas of the thanatopolitics, and Mbe's necropolitics. So just to briefly summarise these approaches, I talk about biopolitical racism, which I'm sure many of you are very familiar with. This productive productive dynamic of optimising life, which Foucault talks about in his analysis of biopolitics. Also, there's this element of the destructive dynamic, right? He talks about biopolitics or biopolitical racism as letting die. So in the paper, I talk about the way in which that sort of separation of life into productive and unproductive elements is bound up with processes of racialization. And these are, you know, this occur in both sites, but in different ways, like, you know, different contexts. So, of course, in the US case, it's, you know, typically Mexican migration. This is a racialized migration at the US-Mexico border in the Mediterranean. Primarily in sub-Saharan African migration. So that biopolitical racism is an important tool in understanding how governing migration through death becomes institutionalised, if you like. I also talk about what Vaughan Williams describes as the thanatopolitical drift. So this is the lethal dimensions of sovereign biopower, which Agamben talks about. Bare life, that life which can be just left, you know, it can just be left to die. So there's strong connections here between Foucault and Agamben in the literature already, in critical border studies literature, to understand this phenomena of border deaths. I think we can really see that, for example, in the US case. So as I mentioned, the deaths on the US-Mexico border from around the mid-1990s, this was actually set up, if you like, as the desert was explicitly utilised in that context as a tool of border migration control. So 1993, Operation Blockade El Paso. This was the beginning of the shift from apprehending undocumented migrants towards deterrent policies, preventative policies. So Timothy Dunn describes this operation in terms of what he says, some 400 agents directly on the banks of the Rio Grande in a high visibility fashion to deter unauthorized or illegal border crossings. He describes how officials acknowledge this would lead border crossers to more hostile terrain. So we can see biophysical violence, you know, really engaged here. Does it mobilise directly for the purposes of border control? And this then informed the 1994 Southwest border strategy, which is really about making it so difficult for people to cross illegally because of the desert as being such a brutal, hostile site. Now, scholars like Roxanne Lynn Doty have argued that in this context, the desert and natural forms of death which are recorded become a moral alibi for the state. The state doesn't take responsibility for these border deaths because they happen naturally in the desert because of exposure. She makes a strong argument that is a moral alibi for the state. Jason de Leon talks about how there's an erasure of evidence in these contexts in the desert. Evidence disappears. And what I want to... I draw a lot on these scholars, but although one thing that I flag up in the paper is that there's a tendency in this scholarship, it almost that this is simply an intentional move, if you like. There's an intentional move to erase evidence and kill people. In the US context, you know, you can see why scholars ask that, you know, take that view, because there was this explicit desire to use the desert for border control. But I don't, in my paper, I do just try to distinguish from that intentional reading of what's happening here and instead really point to the ways in which, you know, sometimes erasure fails. So it's not a simple erasure of evidence. The question of intentionality is a very, you know, I see it as not really a very helpful avenue to go down. But what's important, I think, is that if we take on board the fact that there is this process of biophysical violence where people are dying in these hostile terrains, it demands an increased responsibility on the part of states and actors that can respond. So that's how I would, the argument that I would make about this. The third sort of power dynamics that I draw attention to in the paper is necropolitics, the necropolitical. This is coming from Membe's idea of the subjection of life to death. This production of disposable populations, whole populations, if you like, the living dead, a kind of sense of extreme hopelessness. And it's been important for scholars of the periphery, if you like, looking at the ongoing kind of colonial power dynamics. But also, you know, it's important in understanding how privilege is maintained and also the conditions of hopelessness which serve as a condition for people to escape, for flight to happen. So this is a kind of third dynamic that I draw attention to in the paper for understanding the ways in which this production of the governing of migration through deaths is institutionalised through these power dynamics. So one of the key points then is that these dynamics come together that I make in the paper. These multiple operations of power come together, and I try to understand that in the paper. Speaking first to the question of the US and the European context and that comparative question that I ask, my conclusions are really that there are definitely contextualised differences, and we'll see a few more of those as I go through the talk further. But in a sense, there's many more convergences here. In a way, there's more of the most obvious difference is perhaps a quantitative one, going back to, you know, the original slide and how many deaths are occurring in the Mediterranean. Some similarities are intensification, militarisation of border security, we see in both contexts, population surveillance, you know, checking of border control surveillance, institutionalised detention and deportation, border controls being externalised, pushed out further, be that to the southern Mexican border, be that to various African states, coupling of humanitarianism with border security. There's been a lot of scholarship on that, particularly in the European context, but that's also a dynamic we can see in the US context. So a lot of similarities. And overall, the core similarity is this deterrent approach, right? Blurring the distinction between biopolitical drive to let die, a lethal fanatopolitical drift that kills, necropolitical conditions that drive flight from what we might call a living death and being a disposable life. So that would be my analysis of the two contexts. As I said, one of the points I make in the paper is that there are these dynamics of different power dynamics coming together through this. The destructive tendencies of biophysical violence, I argue in the paper, are widely tolerated. So I want to just talk a bit about the different ways in which biophysical violence is physical violence enacted on bodies moving through deserts, seas, other hostile terrains. How is that being tolerated? I talked already about Roxanne Lynn Doty's work, the moral alibi, the evasion of culpability through processes of denial. So, you know, these are natural deaths. It's not really our fault. It's not great, but, you know, it's not really our fault. That would be one way in which biophysical violence is tolerated. Second way, we might understand as a displacement of culpability onto the person who's at risk of death. So, you know, it's actually the person themselves that makes that decision to make that journey. What, you know, maybe they realise about the dangers or not to a greater or lesser extent, but, you know, we're actually doing search and rescue. It's not our fault that people are dying. So here we see this victimisation, right, of the person, the migrant, not a victim of institutionalised power dynamics, biopolitics, thanatopolitics, necropolitics, but a victim of their own inability to accurately recognise danger. So I call this in the paper the displacement of culpability. The third way in which I talk about this toleration of biophysical violence is in terms of rejecting culpability. They're all quite connected, but this is an example here would be the way in which, you know, we've seen this massive focus in the European context on anti-smuggling, haven't we? So, you know, the real problem is the smugglers. This blaming of the criminal networks, if not migrants or refugees directly for these deaths. The fourth, there's a fourth way in which I argue in the paper that biophysical violence is tolerated, and that is through compensatory measures. And that's something that I do go into the paper in more detail. I go into this, particularly through looking at forms of identifying and burying the dead. I think a classic example of, you know, these compensatory measures would probably be Italy following the 3rd of October 2013 massive shipwreck. And some of you might remember there was this, you know, this call to let's actually make the dead citizens so we can give them a proper state funeral. So, and there's lots of, you know, problems with that. They didn't do it in the end. People who survived were, you know, just treated as normal detainees. So there was, you know, there's many problems with that, but this is a sort of compensatory measure, I think, for dealing with this phenomena of border deaths. And Kim Rogel talks about the paradox whereby people often count more in death than they do in life, you know, as undocumented or irregular migrants. There's some really interesting work I'll just sort of point to you if you're interested in this area, in terms of the documentation of people's lives. De Leon's done a lot of work here collecting artifacts left behind in the desert by people making the journey in the US, preserving belongings to document those lives of the dead. Simon Robbins, some of you might know, there's been recent reports around processes of identifying the dead in the European context. And I just would like to talk a bit about some of the differences in identifying and burying the dead in the US and the European context. And I think this is important because this is a way that we can think about how far these compensatory measures are in operation, but also their limits, you know, how the toleration of border deaths also slips into, you know, dehumanisation of those people on the move. Okay, so US and Europe, in terms of looking at the differences, I think, and I must just say that my work in the US context is a bit more dated, and I wasn't focusing on this in a lot of detail when I was there. So I've also drawn on some secondary literature, and I think it's comparative work that, you know, can really be done in a lot more detail. But one of the notable things in the US was the emphasis on identifying the dead. Really some very significant efforts made, particularly by Pima County Medical Officer. I was in Arizona doing my research. Often very concerted efforts to make the identification of those people who died. And also with facilities. So this is the body crawler outside the US Pima County Medical Officer's office. So, but also there's an issue here about the anonymity of people. So identification isn't very easy. Even when there's concerted efforts made in the US context, it requires DNA identification from countries of origin. So it's not straightforward. So there are many people who, in that context, who are not identified and who are then buried without, you know, being named. So anonymous graves in this case, this is an example of, there's often a section in US cemeteries and for indigent graves. So, you know, those people who can't afford to have a proper gravestone, but this will be where irregular migrants, undocumented migrants are buried. And they will have this John Doe, which means we unnamed. So there's this anonymity to the process of burial. But there's also very different practices in the US. So I've talked about the Pima County Medical Officer, the efforts there, but there's also private burials. There have been cases of people found in mass graves, not separated, not properly identified. Bodies have been exhumed and had to go through reburial. So there's been very mixed practices in the US context. If we can go back and look in terms of Europe, I think, you know, one of the things you've possibly seen on the news is just the, you know, I think particularly in Greece, that I remember seeing a news broadcast of a guy from Huddersfield who had just volunteered to go and make the process of burial more humane. So in the European context, there has been this situation where, especially on Greek islands, where there's a lack of, you know, experience of dealing with suddenly, you know, large numbers of dead bodies to deal with. Italy has been dealing with this for longer. What's happened, you know, now more recently is there is identification, DNA identification in both contexts. But recent scholarship has shown that the process of identification is not effective. You know, simple measures such as speaking to survivors of shipwrecks, keeping documentation or belongings, in order to find out names where people are from, this isn't happening. So in a way, this, as I said before, in the US context, collecting DNA is, you know, doesn't really work if you've got no additional information, and you've also got the problem of linking to DNA of families. So there's movement in the European context, but it's not effective. This is a picture I took graves in Lampedusa. We can see it's quite interesting because here there's not such a separation, although it varies you know, it varies widely according to cemeteries and locations, but we see very clearly the difference here between a local Lampedusan baby's grave and then on the left-hand side graves, which in fact it's kind of unusual that they've got the that they've actually got these plaques up at all, because there's many without anything. This in Lampedusa, for a particular reason, a particular person working in the right department for a couple of years meant that there was a few years where these plaques were being put up on the graves, but the information is about, you know, three men, probably from sub-Saharan region or Maghreb region, probably between the ages of 20 and 35. This is the sort of level of identification and what's included there. So the toleration, this compensatory measures tolerating border deaths, you start to see this breaking down when we're looking at identification and burial practices. In fact, a lot of a kind of lack of care, we start to see, you know, see that feeding through in burial as well. What I look at in this paper is death as a site. I take death as a site of political struggle. So there's a growing body of scholarship looking at this from different angles. And what really struck me in looking in this area was the way that dignity often comes up as a way of dealing or giving some humanity back to people in death. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the concept of dignity after, and just to give you an idea of why, just to highlight some key phrases that have come out of my research. So both in the US and Italy here, an indigenous undertaker from Arizona talks about that there was a debate, you know, can we afford to have these gravestones and engrave John Doe on them? And he's debating that, and he's saying, well, we still need to maintain their dignity, don't we? But by the same token, it would save us money to not to engrave the John Does. And why, you know, why are we doing that? So he has this kind of debate with himself about it. In Italy, the research I've done for my current project, there's quite a lot of work in the Lampedusan cemetery, which I just showed you the picture from, where they're making a lot of efforts precisely to identify people, to remark graves, to share people's stories, information about them. And that this is seen specifically as providing dignity in death to these people who have died en route. In Italy specifically, dignity is such an important concept because of the prominence of Catholicism in public discourse. So Pope Francis called the 3rd of October 2013 deaths a disgrace, has talked about Europe as a beacon of principles of equality and dignity inherent in human nature. And Artina Catena talks about the Pope as peopling the state based on the God-given dignity of those otherwise exploited by Europe's labour and border security practices. So dignity, going back to my original question, you know, how can we not only understand how governing migration through death becomes a norm, but how can we start, you know, what mechanisms are there for transforming this? Dignity has, you know, come in not necessarily with, you know, with that purpose in mind, but you can see people reaching to the concept of dignity to try to deal with this situation where, you know, where the deaths are happening, the toleration of those deaths are apparent. This is one concept that seems to be emerging as important in both sides. So question then, does dignity or human dignity provide scope for this transformation of a troubling situation where death becomes a norm through which migration is governed? And I unpack in the final part of my paper recent and longer histories of this concept. So obviously human rights and humanitarian law, dignity is a key concept here. Article 1 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights begins by stating that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. Article 1 of Germany's Basic Law says human dignity is inviolable. And then in humanitarian law, the International Committee of Red Cross in the preamble to Geneva Convention says that respect for the personality and dignity of human beings constitutes a universal principle which is binding even in the absence of any contractual undertaking. So we see this as a very important concept embedding the legal framework currently, but if we also unpack historically, looking to classical Roman thought, for example, dignitas hominis, this is a limited status, right? A limited status for those of reputation, reputation and privilege. So it was often for people, in office, or it was even could be applied to institutions directly, but it was a privilege. Dignity is a privileged status there. Cicero's work, this is where dignity is very much about the human over animals. Okay, so just to use a quote from Cicero, remember always how vastly superior is man's nature to that of cattle and other animals. Their only thought is for bodily satisfactions. Man's mind, on the contrary, is developed by study and reflection. From this we may learn that sensual pleasure is wholly unworthy of the dignity of the human race. So again, there's clear hierarchies, isn't there, involved in this concept of dignity, between either humans having greater status or humans having status over animals. And we can see that similarly if we go look into Judeo-Christian tradition. Grotius's idea of dignity, of death, even of enemies in warfare. So again, there's the kind of division of man from animals here. He states that the rights of nature and men the rights and nature of men, even enemies, cannot be denied a proper burial. So dignity is important in death here, but dignity is also defining man from animal, that even the worst man deserves a decent burial. Pico della Mirandola's Oration of the Dignity of Man. Again, there's a hierarchy here. Free choice of man. Man's made in the image of God. This is a superior life based on the divine. And dignity is conceptualized in those terms. So I think what's clear is that human dignity, historically embeds these superior and inferior lives. Is that a clear tradition from the Roman through the Judeo-Christian, but also, of course, through the Enlightenment conception of human autonomy in Kant's work. So dignity here defined in terms of the treatment of people as ends and not means. And so what I suggest in the paper is that dignity, obviously I'm not fully confident that dignity or human dignity is a concept that has the critical potential to transform this situation where death becomes a norm, precisely because this hierarchy is also hierarchies we're seeing through, if we look back to the theories I introduced at the beginning, biopolitics, thanatopolitics. Other scholars have talked about zoopolitics, like people being treated like animals. We could see the replaying of these dynamics through the concept of dignity itself as well. So worthy and unworthy lives, superior and inferior lives, is something that biophysical violence thrives on, I would argue. And in a sense, that sort of biopolitical drive to maximise life and the provision of dignity in death doesn't deal with these destructive tendencies. That's my overarching argument. So, I guess the other thing, though, I would say here is, human dignity is also an ambiguous concept. There is that hierarchy and differentiation embedded there, but there's also tensions between egalitarian and hierarchical strands of that. So we see that, of course, human rights, the universality of dignity, also in the Catholic tradition, as a revision of the concept of dignity from a hierarchical to a more egalitarian one. So there's sort of ambiguous. I really argue that human dignity is an ambiguous way forward, not a completely hopeless way forward. In terms of biophysical violence in the modern humanist tradition, As I said, biophysical violence, like biopolitics, thrives in hierarchical distinctions and divisions, and compensatory measures do no more than tolerate these, so they're not adequate. But I think also thinking about the liberal Western Judeo-Christian tradition of humanism, which dignity is embedded within, also fails to address the relationship between humans and nature critically enough, I would argue. And this failure provides biophysical violence with its effective force because it's tolerated rather than engaged in a responsive and a responsible way. So my current project, these are the questions that I'm asking, is whether the so-called migration crisis or refugee crisis is better understood as a crisis of modern humanism than as a crisis simply of sovereign border control or humanitarianism, which some have argued is how it could be understood. And if so, can human dignity be mobilised differently as a ground for contestations that effectively challenge practices of governing migration through death? Thank you.